Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 9th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Wrestling with a Stranger, Session 3 of God in the Highest Heavens, God Wrestling in the Mud, a Bible study presented by Jonathan Preuss, number PRJ 2003-03. Let's listen in.
Coming in, I'll do this little book thing. These are some books that are in the library here. This is a kind of a standard, more thorough study of the book of Genesis by Walter Brueggemann, who's a very interesting writer. And this is a book I've never seen before, The Women of Genesis. So I get another look at Rachel and Leah and their handmaids among the other women, Sarah, Rebecca, Dinah. This is a Jewish study of the book of Genesis, called Understanding Genesis. And this is a journalist's version of the whole Torah, the five books of Moses. He decided to go every place by land where the Israelites, or Abraham, or Jacob, or whoever, had been. And sometimes walking, sometimes in a jeep or a camel, or however he could get there. He's Jewish himself, and it was kind of sort of a faith walk for him. It's kind of like this. Anybody read the story Spill, the book Spillville? Is that the name of it? That one in the Iowa town where the Jewish conservative Jews made a slaughterhouse. Isn't that Spillville?
Yes.
Yeah. And that he has kind of a similar experience too. When he deals with those people. That's a different book.
That's a different book.
But it's the same sort of a thing. It's a Jewish journalist in both cases who kind of gets in touch with his roots by this journey, his contact with.
This author,
in this case, the land, in that case, the modern people.
This author has written a book called Abraham.
Yes.
For this one.
Yeah, he's written. Let's see, what else is there?
And that's where it wouldn't be noted on that book because he wrote it after this
one.
It
was after this one.
Yes.
Okay.
And here he examines the three faiths with the common.
Yeah. This main theme here seems to be to show that Christianity, Islam, Judaism are really all basically the same. They have common roots and they have enough in common that they should just celebrate their commonality and not fight with each other. I think that's what I got out of my brief look at the book. Is that fair?
I think he certainly shows differences among the three, but he does emphasize that we do have Abraham in common, even though the interpretation of Abraham is different.
I wonder if he was involved with that Time magazine article. Remember that came out?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember just when that was, but there was a picture of Abraham on the cover about to slaughter Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
And that was written mostly from a Jewish point of view.
Yes.
But had that same theme that
we
all have
his faith. He is Jewish.
Yeah. I wonder if he was involved with that one. Could have been. And then this is the one, once again, this is the one that I've been reading from, Robert Alter, Genesis, Translation and Notes. Well, let's start with prayer. Gracious God, this is a beautiful day you've given us, and these are wonderful stories that you've given us. We thank you for preserving them through all these millennia down to our time, for the universal characteristics and for the peculiar and intriguing aspects of the stories. We thank you for all of it. We pray your Spirit's presence be among us and moving us and teaching us and guiding our discussion today. In Jesus' name. Another little business item. On the third, tomorrow it's all my children. David's family gets out of hand. Second Samuel will go to a different book. It's got something in common with Jacob's later years too. It's not so different. Then Friday, Villager's Choice. Jonah, Job, or Ecclesiastes? Got any preferences? We won't do all of Job, but we could do all of it. We can read through Jonah. It's not that long. Ecclesiastes, you can't read through all that, but we can read representative sections of it so you get the flavor of it. Maybe you've done one or the other recently, you want to do a different one? Or you like one? Speak.
Jonah.
A vote for Job, a vote for Jonah, more than one maybe? Well, let's just go down. Let's be democratic. How many for Jonah? There's four, five. How many for Job? There's four, five, six. How many for Ecclesiastes? One, two, three, four, five. This isn't Chicago, this is Holden Village. Well, that's kind of a toss-up. I guess I'll just do what I feel like. I don't get any strong guidance here, so. You get a second chance tomorrow. If you get any stronger views after looking at it. Well, today, we've got the wrestling with the stranger. And we read about Leah's and Rachel's contest over Jacob, and the outcome being these, so far, 11 boys and one girl. And we have lacking one of the 12 tribes. The promise of God to Abraham and passed on to Jacob, to Isaac, and then to Jacob. We see it really shaping up in its fulfillment. Here are the fathers of those 12 tribes. And the atmosphere in Laban's household becomes decidedly uncomfortable for Jacob and also for his wives, as it turns out. And he concludes that it's time to go home. In fact, he tells his wife that God has told him to come home, which, in fact, God has told him that. It's time to go home. And so he starts working with Laban to get his share of the flocks that he has tended and multiplied and taken good care of for all these years. And tries to make a deal for all the spotted and striped and black sheep, which would be the recessive genes that would produce those. And Laban says, that's fine. Yeah, you can have those. And then the very next day, he takes his boys and herds all of those miscolored sheep far away where Jacob can't get at them. So Jacob realizes that he's going to have to get in his usual way, by sneakiness and trickery. And he does some creative breeding. I don't know if this is magic or good breeding. I've heard both versions of it. To get the flocks to produce not only spotted and speckled and black sheep, but also to make the strongest, the best of the flock look that way. Now this would take some time, but he builds up another flock of these spotted and speckled critters and eventually runs away with Leah and Rachel's agreement. They say, we don't have any share in our father's inheritance. He's treated us like merchandise. He sold us. We don't have anything to stay here for. Let's go. So they're ready to go. And while Laban is off shearing the sheep, 3 days' journey away from the camp, they run away. Laban finds out about it and chases after them, and it's a pretty ugly scene there. He's very angry, and not only have they gone away without saying goodbye, but Rachel has taken what? His teraphim, his household gods. And Laban, that seems to be the thing that most upsets Laban. And he rummages around through the tents and can't find them. And Rachel is in her tent, sitting on the camel saddle with these teraphim under the saddle. So they're not big, they must be small things. And said, when he comes looking, there's his, sorry, Father, I can't get up and greet you. I'm having my period. So he leaves her alone. And Jacob has said, anyone who's in whose possession these are found shall die, endangering unknowingly his dearest of his wives. But it turns out okay. Laban, then he has to kind of cool down when he doesn't find them. Then Jacob lights into Laban and chews him up for all the mistreating and cheating he's done. He said, you've changed my wages how many times? And so there was no way I could get what was mine except the way I did. And so there's a kind of a wary truce between them, which is celebrated by the building of a pillar and a mound of stones and an agreement and a kind of a, I don't know if it's a curse or a warning, at least calling God to witness. May God watch between you and me until we meet again. Now this has become sort of a love song, you know, but it wasn't originally. You know, but it's supposed to be love, parting lovers. May God watch between us. It isn't that way at all. It's a mutual non-aggression pact. this pillar is a mark that we agree in God's sight that neither one of us will pass this mark to do harm to the other one. And then they eat together as a kind of a seal of that agreement. Laban goes on his way and Jacob goes on his way. And so having made at least an uneasy peace on his eastern frontier, now Jacob turns west. And that's where we start today in Genesis 32. And Laban rose early in the morning and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. So at least he leaves in good form after all the unpleasantness of the day before. And Laban went off and returned to his place. And Jacob had gone on his way, and messengers of God accosted him. And Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the steppe of Edom. And he charged them, saying, thus shall you say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, with Laban I have sojourned, and I tarried till now, and I have gotten oxen and donkeys and sheep, and male and female slaves, and I send ahead to tell my lord to find favor in your eyes. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother, to Esau, and he himself is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. And Jacob was greatly afraid, and he was distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, the sheep and the cattle and the camels, into two camps. And he thought, should Esau come to the one camp and strike it, the remaining camp will escape. And Jacob said, God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, Lord, who has said to me, return to your land and your birthplace, and I will deal well with you. I am unworthy of all the kindness that you have steadfastly done for your servant. For with my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Oh, save me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and strike me, mother with sons. And you yourself said, I will surely deal well with you, and I will set your seed like the sand of the sea, multitudinous beyond all count. And he passed that same night there. And he took from what he had in hand a tribute to Esau his brother, 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 he-asses. And he put them in the hands of his servants, each herd by itself. And he said to his servants, pass on before me, put distance between one herd and the next. And he charged the first one, saying, when Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, whose man are you and where are you going and whose are these herds before you? You shall say, they are your servant Jacob's, a tribute sent to my lord Esau. And look, he himself is behind us. And he charged the second one as well, and also the third. Indeed, all those who went after the herd say, in this fashion you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, look, your servant Jacob himself is behind us. For he thought, let me placate him with the tribute that goes before me, and after I shall look on his face, perhaps he will show me a kindly face. And the tribute passed on before him, and he spent that night in the camp. Well, Esau is approaching with 400 men. What is Jacob thinking? What is he thinking?
Buy him off.
Buy him off. And behave toward him as... The language is that of a vassal to an overlord. My servant, my lord. And he calls what he sends. He tells the servants to call it tribute. Who gives tribute? The vassal to the overlord. He's going to soften Jacob's heart. And he sends the herds one by one, with a space between them. Why does he do that?
Buy time.
Maybe it's more impressive that way, isn't it? And also buys time, gives Esau time to cool off if he's angry, and warm to his brother. When he speaks to his servants, Jacob says, my brother Esau, but he tells him, when you speak to him, you call him my lord Esau, and refer to me as your servant Jacob. There, in verses 21, 22, the word face appears four times. And to placate is literally to cover the face. That is, the angry face is to be covered with something that will soften it and mellow it. What else does he do?
He puts his least favorite wives up front, doesn't he?
Yeah, in chapter 33, we haven't read that part yet, but he puts the least valuable, the servant girls and their kids first, and then Leah's kids, and then finally, way in the back, with the hope that if all else fails, these two may escape Rachel and Joseph. So that favoritism that we've seen through the generations is still at work here. And then, kind of a strange thing he does in verse 23 of chapter 32. And he rose on that night. This is after he sent all his tribute out with the servants before him. He rose on that night and took his two wives and his two slave girls and his 11 boys, Dinah isn't mentioned here, and he crossed over the Jabbok Ford. A strange thing to cross the river at night. And he took them and brought them across the stream and brought across all that he had. So maybe he brought the rest of the animals that he hadn't sent ahead. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. And he saw that he had not won out against him. And he touched his hip socket. And Jacob's hip socket was wrenched as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for dawn is breaking. And he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, not Jacob shall your name hence be said, but Israel, for you have striven with God and men, and won out. And Jacob asked and said, tell me your name, pray. And he said, why should you ask me my name? And there he blessed him. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, meaning I have seen God face to face and I came out alive. And the sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, and he was limping on his hip. Therefore the children of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh which is by the hip socket to this day. For he touched Jacob's hip socket at the sinew of the thigh. Well, Jacob, this isn't the first wrestling. Jacob has been wrestling since he was born. When Esau comes out of the womb, Jacob has got a hold of his heel. And he has wrestled with his brother to get the birthright and the blessing. And he has prevailed in both cases. And now he comes down to the river, seems to be with the purpose. He almost seems to have something in mind, that something is going to happen there. Maybe he's been forewarned by the meeting with the emissaries of God at Mahanaim along the way. And who is this that he's wrestling with?
Well, the text says it's God. I've seen God face to face.
Jacob takes it to be God.
But earlier in the text it says that he wrestled with a man.
He wrestled with a man. And there have been other ideas who that could be. Do you have any other thoughts?
Jesus
himself. I read him about that. Well, maybe we'll close with that.
Maybe he's wrestling with himself.
Maybe wrestling with himself. Anybody else?
I'm wondering about the translation of the word man in the New Revised Standard Version. And then also the translation when he said that he had seen God face to face, but yet a couple of verses before it says it was a man.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about the original words and their meanings?
Well, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything too subtle about the words themselves, but there certainly is in the usage of the identifying angel, man, God. All through the stories of the patriarchs, you have this kind of, I wouldn't call it confusion, but kind of a indefiniteness about the identity of people that were angels or God that that meet the patriarchs.
Or man.
Yeah, or man, yeah. For example, remember Abraham at the Oaks of Mamre? Three men come, and Abraham recognizes that these aren't just ordinary guys. His hospitality is, you know, excessive. He hurries to pick the choicest animal from the flock. His wife makes cakes for them, and he feeds them, and he knows, and he stands there watching them, knowing that they have something to say to him, that they're messengers from God. And in fact, they do. What do they tell him?
Sarah
is going to have a child. Next time, next year by this time, you will have that child that God has promised you. And that's what happens. And when he speaks about that, you know, he speaks as though God himself has spoken to him. What are some other cases? There's this kind of indefiniteness about the identity of who's there.
There's some messengers in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Sodom and Gomorrah, yeah. These messengers come to Lot's house, and the people outside want to know them. The men want to know them. And Lot recognizes he's being hospitable, but there's something more. They're angels, and they have powers. They strike blind the people outside, so they're groping for the door, and they have to kind of give up. He recognizes this is a visitation from God. Well, I mean, how does God come to you? Do you see God as God standing there in front of you?
In the 70s, David Yantis wrote a song titled, "Where Do I See God?"
Uh-huh.
And part of the chorus was, "I see God in you."
Okay.
And then described a number of different ways that happens.
Yeah, there's all kinds of different forms in which God appears. Jesus says, you know, when he's dividing the sheep from the goats, I was naked, hungry, imprisoned, thirsty, and you either served me or you didn't, which determines whether you're a sheep or a goat. When did we see you? You know, neither side recognized, those that did and those that didn't recognize that this was Jesus. This is maybe the most down and dirty version of the whole thing. Because this, in this case, he actually wrestles. It's not just an appearance or a word, but it's actual physical wrestling, which leaves its physical mark on Jacob permanently. Others have said this is the spirit of Esau. He's been wrestling with Esau, and his fears of his upcoming meeting with Jacob become embodied in this person that he wrestles with.
Well, that's what I was saying. Maybe he's wrestling with himself, because he knows Esau's coming, and how's he, should he run away? Should he make, sense? Should he try and fight him? He has to spend the night trying to figure that out, so he's kind of wrestling with himself.
The fact also that this person that he wrestles with says, let me go because, why?
Morning is coming.
Morning is coming. Some have said this is an old pre-Hebrew story of somebody wrestling with a night spirit, a river god or something like that. And it's been incorporated into the Jacob story and given a meaning, a consonant with the message of that story. And that's the one element that makes possible that interpretation. But he wouldn't probably ask that sort of person for a blessing. He's aware that this is someone who can bless him, someone who has already blessed him, and he needs it even more now. Yeah?
Two things. One is, if it was Esau, is Esau capable of giving Jacob a blessing?
That's the problem with Esau. Yeah.
Second of all, going back to who is it, and the phrase or the saying, let me go because it's morning is coming, night is ending. Can that go to the hiddenness of God, or to see God face to face in the light? You can't see clearly in the darkness. Mm-hmm. To see God face to face, you won't be able to behold his glory. Is that a later tradition?
Well, there certainly is the idea all through the Old Testament and the New that seeing God face to face is fatal.
So to see him at night, you don't see him face to face.
Yeah, you could.
To see him in the daylight, you run that risk of...
So this whoever he's wrestling with is saying, you better let me go because it's going to kill you if you're still looking at me when the day comes. Yep, you could read it that way too. It isn't the night spirit fearing disclosure, it's God fearing harming Jacob beyond what he's gonna harm him, but he doesn't want to kill him. Mary.
That's in Greek mythology from that time too, the idea that if you ever saw God, it would kill you. So
liberating.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's the one.
And it comes up again in the New Testament, Peter, when after the great catch of fish at Jesus' command, he says, depart from me, O Lord, for I am a sinful man. He's afraid of the presence of God in Jesus that he's just recognizing at that point. And Isaiah, in his vision, he says, oh, woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips. And then the angel comes and touches his lips with a coal to make him fit to speak on behalf of God. Paul talks about somebody, he won't say who it is, being taken, I think he's talking about himself, but we can't be sure, taken up into the seventh heaven, seeing things that cannot be uttered, and living to tell the tale. The author of Revelation also is very fearful and respectful of the things that he's seeing there as well. What's the point of the wrestling? Why? What does it mean?
I think that he's just wrestling with himself, finding to come to a place, as even as Christians, we wrestle with our relationship with God until finally we make him Lord of our life. And I think what was happening here too, God could have won the match anytime he wanted. But he wanted Jacob to come to the point where he would finally say bless and kind of give in. It's just like we say, finally, Lord, be Lord of my life and not myself.
Also, everything Jacob had gotten ever was from tricky and fooling people, and he couldn't fool this guy, and he had to do it in reality, in real time, and you know, he had to fight, he had to really wrestle and be himself, and he couldn't trick him.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
I think it's significant that this happened just before his meeting Esau, and he must still be troubled regarding the deception he was involved in stealing Esau's birthright. I even wondered if the man he was wrestling with was Esau, and that Esau was bringing him a message from God about the upcoming reconciliation.
You know, that isn't totally out of the question, because what does he see when he sees Esau? We haven't got that far yet. He says, seeing your face is like seeing the face of God.
Right.
That's what
and
he says to his brother.
Could this be a prelude to that?
Yeah, so that's a possibility. You can't rule it out. And what does the angel, man, God, whoever it is, say at the end? We haven't read all that yet, have we? Oh, yes, we have.
I think the question is significant, too. Tell me your name as far as the stealing of the birthright again.
Yeah, let me finish that one, come back to this one. Not Jacob shall your name hence be said, but Israel, for you have striven with God and men, and won out. So the idea that he's wrestling with God and with Esau at the same time, you know, it's possible. That's what the guy kind of says, he's striven with God and men. Of course, he's maybe not referring just to this event, this particular match, but Jacob's whole history. But now your second point.
Well, the question that, please tell me your name.
Yeah.
Makes me wonder if, all of this, of course, is a mystery. We'll never know what really happened, right? But it seems likely, it seems reasonable to me that all of this deception and his stealing Esau's birthright, that this happened just before he was going to meet Esau, is significant.
Why is the name so important?
Well, because it's through him that the tribes of Israel.
Cowboy talk, you know, the name is like your handle. And that's not so far off. If you've got the person's name, you have a handle.
It gives you access to that person, a sense of control.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same question Moses asked at the burning bush. Tell me your name so that when I go back to Egypt, but I'm not saying I'll go, so that I can tell the people who sent me.
And God, what does he get?
God says, I am. Tell them I am sent you. And Moses says, thank you very much. I was hoping for a little more.
Later on, Moses wants to see God's glory during the struggles as it time of the Exodus has happened, and God says, well, you can't see my glory and live, but I'll let you see my back. And he hides him in the cleft of a rock, puts his hand over him, walks by, and then you can see his glory as it's kind of fading away. But then eventually Moses receives some of that glory of God in his own face, you know. His face glows when he comes down from the mountain so that the Israelites are afraid of him. And he has to put a veil over his face just to protect them from this reflected glory that he has. But Moses, there are these unusual characters that have a kind of sight and vision, and they see things and understand things that not everybody does. And what answer does he get, Jacob get now when he asks for the name? Why should you ask for my name? Yes.
I wonder if that's, she asked about the significance of the words in those names. The L is the name for God. It's the Kage of Allah. And so Israel you have striven with God, mm-hmm. and then, and he's told him that so that why do you ask? By giving you this name, I've already told you who I am.
If you were listening.
Yeah.
And then you would have got it. Yeah, and I'm not going to tell you again if you don't get it. Yeah, it could be read that way too. You've already heard it. Why do you want to hear it again? Well, you brought up all the possibilities that I can think of. You yourselves have brought them all up. There may be some others that we haven't thought of. What does this... Let's talk a little bit about the night wrestling. What difference does it make this was at night? We've already talked about the identity of the wrestling person wrestling with Jacob is hidden by night, just as the identity of Leah is hidden by night once before. But what does that mean, that they're wrestling at night? What happens in the nighttime? You ever lie awake at night and all of the fears that you kept suppressed by busyness during the day come to keep you awake and keep your mind buzzing? In the daytime, Jacob is very busy figuring things out, taking action to protect his family and his possessions and himself, sending offering, managing his forces, and so forth. But in the night, there's nothing more he can do. All of the fears and uncertainties just come and pile on him. He faces his mortality, I think. Mark Twain says, the prospect of death concentrates the mind wonderfully. And people speak of their heightened awareness of God and of everything around them when they've had a brush with death. Heart attack, bypass surgery, and that sort of thing. One person wrote, I came home from the hospital and I sat with my Bible in the usual place where I read and pray. A red cardinal appeared and sang, and it was like an epiphany. It was so powerfully beautiful. Something I've seen many times before, but now I saw something in that simple thing I never saw before. Maybe that's part of what's happening to Jacob too. In this moment of a mortal threat, his mind, all of the things that have been working in his mind focus, and he sees the possibility that he isn't going to survive this thing. Not only that, the same fear that though we hear nothing about it, that Abraham faced as he went up the mountain with Isaac, that not only himself and his hope, all of the future that God has promised is also at risk at this time, because we don't know what Esau is going to do. How about, that's mortality, how about morality? Jacob has always been, he's still a devious person. Somebody wrote, God uses crooked sticks to draw straight lines. Or another way to look at it, Jacob has to be bent by his wrestling with this night wrestler to be straight enough to meet with Esau. His hip was put out of joint at the hands of his best friend too. And that happened to me. I was wrestling my best friend on a raft out of Pebble Lake, Fergus Falls. We were probably about 20 at the time. And we had been working in road construction together. There were four buddies that used to horse around together. Five of us, but the fifth wasn't around so much. And we were playing King on the Raft. And he got a good grip on me, and he threw me off. Only I foolishly grabbed hold of his arm like Jacob grabbed Esau's heel. And it kept me from flying free. And I hit the edge of the dock like this with my hip, and the hip joint just popped like that. And I felt my whole side just go numb. And I was in deep water. So the only thing I thought is, just keep your head above water. That's the first thing. Keep your head above water. You know, paddling with your hands. I still was okay with my upper body. And got to shore somehow. And was limping around for quite a while after that. I couldn't walk at all for about a week. And I still feel it when the weather changes, you know. So I've got a little Jacob. So you cannibals out there, if you're going to eat me, leave that spot on my hip. Don't eat that part. How about morality? Jacob is this devious person. And here he is, the bearer of the promise, and wrestles with God, and is blessed and promised protection by God. Maybe this isn't so much about morality as it is about grace. God's undeserved mercy to somebody that doesn't, you know, is not that fine a person in human terms. And yet he is attached to God. No, physically attached even, you know, at this time of wrestling. And he doesn't ignore God. He has a sense that his hope is in God, and he clings to God and calls upon God, claims God's promises that have been given to him before. What is it that straightens you up? What is it that makes you a useful person? Is it threats and fear and punishment? Or is it grace and mercy, unexpected? Or is it a combination of the two, the carrot and the stick? Maybe the threat of punishment keeps you from doing certain things. You know, what Martin Luther called the civil use of the law keeps you from driving beyond 60 when you come up along Lake Chelan because there's patrol cars all along there all the time. Or what is it, 50? It's kind of slow along the lake there.
You sound like you speak from experience.
I haven't been stopped, but the taxi driver, we came up in a taxi, the driver was very careful. No, I mean it along the Columbia River coming up to Chelan. The taxi driver says, I've only gotten one ticket in 17 years of driving here, whatever it is. Sometimes God turns you around by doing something just totally unexpected and generous to you. I think one person who influenced me a lot was quite aware of my mistakes. He knew me very well. But he was so kind and accepting that I felt like I wanted to be the kind of person that he pretended that I was. His graciousness had a power in my life that maybe threats and punishment and did things for me that the usual persuasions couldn't do. And that's sometimes how God works with us. There's an artist named Hugh who was struggling in his mind about an important commission for a painting that he had to begin the next day. And that night he was lying in bed trying to sleep when he heard a noise in the room near the door. A black shadow came into the room and walked slowly around the room, and Hugh sat up in bed, just his hair standing up. What is this? It was some black thing. Suddenly jumped up on the bed. It was a big black dog. And Hugh grabbed the dog and he was wrestling with this dog. And he thought in the middle, this is really silly. Why am I lying in bed wrestling with a dog? And then the dog just vanished. And he fell asleep. And he remembered it in the morning, obviously. And he concluded that the dog represented the fears and concerns he had about this project, whether he was really going to be able to do it. Of course, that's certainly an element of this wrestling. Jacob is wrestling with his fears about Esau and his fears about the whole promise that, you know, is wrapped up in all in this family that he has. Is he maybe thinking about Cain and Abel? You know, brothers have killed brothers before. Have you ever faced that? You're going to meet somebody who has been an adversary, someone you have wronged, or who has wronged you, and you're just terrified to face that person. And you, you know, and it magnifies. It gets worse and worse and worse the more you think about it. And you'd really rather run the other way, but you don't really have that choice. Because even when you run away, what do you take with you? The fears are still there. You're still all that you are and you've been through, you've done, is still there, is with you. I think some people travel, like they're trying to get away from something that just won't let them go. And it doesn't matter where you go, it's still there. You can just distract yourself, Jim, then.
A couple of things. I've been wondering since we first talked about Esau sending emissaries, what's going on in Esau's mind here? Why didn't he send his emissaries to say, you know, don't worry about it, I'm going to forgive you? I mean, obviously,
yeah,
from a storytelling perspective, it provides,
yeah,
for all this tension, but do you think he is, I mean, what's going on in his mind? I think it's a really interesting question. Does he maybe have fears about what Jacob's going to do, or is he want to toy with Jacob a little bit and make him wonder, or?
Well, what's Esau been like? He's not a very reflective guy. You know, he just sells his birthright just like that without thinking of the future. I don't know if he's even thinking about what Jacob is feeling. I don't think he has that, you know, that,
yeah,
sensitivity. Maybe not. That's my impression of him. I could be wrong about that. He could be toying with him, but I don't think he's devious enough to do that.
Well, there was 400 men. He may just want to scare the bejeebers out of him to kind of get even for,
yeah,
what he's done.
If he is thinking about it, he's thinking, well, if he's scared, good. I ain't going to hurt him, but let,
yeah,
him think,
yeah,
I am.
Yeah,
let him, it's possible.
Yeah.
You're going
to
see that.
I just think it's so fascinating to think of all of these kinds of stories from two perspectives, from the perspective of reality, the chance that this could have really happened, or that it is simply a psychological sort of story going on, and whether you look at it either way, it really doesn't make a difference because the outcome is the same in many ways. But I think what you said about struggling, you said about struggling with yourself and sort of the inner self and wrestling with God and wrestling with the ideas and even this happening at nighttime because it's in the pits of our despair that we have a choice. We can either choose to wrestle with God and come out on the other side, or we can choose not to wrestle and remain in a depression and remain in the darkness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it. But
mm-hmm.
at the very end, Jacob's hip, it's a constant reminder of what has gone on. And you do carry that with you always, no matter where you come out of. You know, if you come out on the other side and you embrace God or embrace life or whatever, you still always have the reminder of what it was that brought you to that spot. And Jacob now has this constant reminder of the hip. So it's kind of interesting to think of it both ways, I think.
There's real wisdom in what you said about wrestling it through. You know, face the thing that it is that's threatening you and get at it, you know, deal with it, rather than run away, and it doesn't go away. It just goes along with you. Like, you remember Joe Butzfeldt and Little Abner? He's got this little cloud,
yes,
raining over his head, doesn't hit anybody else. He never can get away from it.
Well, in some ways, Jacob is the same way. He's run away from what he's done. He's lived for a,
yeah,
long time. He's had all these wives. He's had all these kids.
Yeah.
You know, all this kind of thing. But he hasn't had to face what he's really done until this moment.
And he comes back with God's promise. You remember, God has promised, I will go with you, and I will bring you back safely home again. And he does cling to that promise. And that's part of what he is wrestling about. It's the blessing. He wants a renewal of that promise to make sure that that's really going to be the case. And that's true. Depression is a kind of result of trying to escape things that you need to face and wrestle them through. Well, let's read about when they meet. What happens? Chapter 33. We got time to do this? Yeah, good. And Jacob raised his eyes and saw, and look, Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. And he divided the children between Leah and Rachel, and between the two slave girls. And he placed the slave girls and their children first, and Leah and her children after them, and Rachel and Joseph last. And he passed before them and bowed to the ground 7 times until he drew near his brother. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck, and they wept. And he raised his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, who are these with you? And he said, the children with whom God has favored your servant. And the slave girls drew near, they and their children, and they bowed down.
and Leah too, and her children drew near, and they bowed down. And then Joseph and Rachel drew near and bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this camp I have met? That means the animals that he sent ahead of it. And he said, to find favor in the eyes of my Lord. And Esau said, I have much, my brother. Keep what you have. And Jacob said, oh no, pray, if I have found favor in your eyes, take this tribute from my hand. For have I not seen your face as one might see God's face? And you receive me in kindness. So we're back to this face idea. Pray, take my blessing that has been brought you. For God has favored me, and I have everything. And he pressed him, and he took it. And he said, let us journey onward and go, and let me go alongside you. And he said, my Lord knows that the children are tender, and the nursing sheep and cattle are my burden, and if they are whipped onward a single day, all the flocks will die. Pray, let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I shall drive along at my own easy pace, at the heels of the livestock before me and at the heels of the children, till I come to my Lord in Seir. And Esau said, pray, let me set aside for you some of the people who are with me. He wants to send some of his people along with Jacob. And he said, why should I find such favor in the eyes of my Lord? And Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, while Jacob journeyed on to Succoth. And he built himself a house, and for his cattle he made sheds. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. It's the name of the Jewish festival of sheds, or tabernacles, or huts, booths. Well, Jacob comes through once more. He and all his survive. His brother is greets him kindly, and this ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck. Does this remind you of something in the New Testament, one of Jesus' stories? Isn't that the story of the prodigal son?
It reminds me.
Yeah, it really is. While he was yet far off, the father ran to him. It's very much like that story. Notice, just like the flocks are sent on separately, the three companies of wives and children come separately. The slave girls and hers, they come and bow. Then the next one comes and bows. And then finally, Rachel and Joseph come and bow. And Joseph bows seven times. Esau doesn't stand on ceremony. He just runs and hugs his brother. And they wept. I bet they both wept. Jacob's, I don't like to think about feeling, but if it doesn't tell you about it, then you're just making up. But they're weeping. You can kind of imagine what's going on in between the two.
Esau really is pretty benevolent there, isn't he?
He is. He's not such a bad guy. Jacob keeps addressing him as my Lord. He's never quite confident. And Esau wants to spend a little more time with him. He wants him to come visit him at his home, apparently, in Seir. But Jacob, is he totally convinced of Esau's benevolence? Apparently not. He seems to exaggerate the fragility of his herds and his family. And says, oh, no, I have these weak flocks, nursing sheep, and my little children. They can't stand another day of hard journey. So let me come along slowly, and I'll come and visit you later. Does he?
No.
He doesn't go to Seir at all.
I think it's interesting in this reconciliation, at least on Esau's part, it's not 100% on Jacob's part, it appears. There's no confession of past wrongdoing towards Esau. On Jacob's part, there's reconciliation without confession.
Yep.
Or attempt at reconciliation.
And the word blessing comes up in verse 11. Pray, when Esau says, yeah, you don't need to give me all this stuff, I've got plenty. He said, pray, take my blessing that has been brought you, for God has favored me, and I have everything. What does Esau say? I have much, my brother. And Jacob says, I have everything.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well,
is there a little dig there?
Mm-hmm.
I've got the blessing. I'm going to share some with you. But, you know, still
but
mine.
He got the blessing fraudulently.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't apologize. In words, he doesn't apologize. But certainly his behavior is very apologetic. I mean, giving all this tribute to him and his attitude of humility and so forth before his brother. But he doesn't ever really trust him.
It kind of reminds me of the Joseph story, too, where they, you know, they don't fully believe that Joseph is forgiven. And
yeah.
They come to him and say, they make up this promise, you know, that they lied to him to say that our father, you know, asked us to eat for us.
Yeah, yeah. And that's completely settled. No, they aren't.
That wrestling keeps going on.
Maybe that's so there's another episode. You know? It's never completely settled. Well, that's the character of life, isn't it? Do you ever have any events that completely wrap up something thoroughly and in every detail? No, I've never seen that. You reach relative points of conclusion. But there's this kind of sense of incompleteness in his life that is never quite gone, no matter what happens. And maybe that's the way we were meant. Our hearts are restless, O Lord, until they rest in Thee, as Augustine said. Then Jacob... We have to read the next little bit. Verse 18. And Jacob came in peace to the town of Shechem. He didn't leave it in peace, but he comes in peace, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the town. And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the sons of Hamor, father of Shechem, for 100 kesetahs. And he set up an altar there and called it El Elohei Israel. That is God, God of Israel. So he owns a little piece of the promised land now, too. He's in the land of Canaan. He comes in peace to the land of Canaan. What did God promise him when he first set out? I will be with you. I will go with you wherever you go, and you shall return in peace. Well, now it's happened. There is a kind of a conclusion here, although he hasn't fully settled with his brother. If you will bring me home in peace, Jacob says, you'll be my God. Remember that? When he set out, and now God has brought him home in peace, and what does he do? Well, he does fulfill his vow. He set up an altar there and called it El Elohei Israel. This is an altar to my God, because I'm Israel. That's the name of God. If you will bring me home in peace. Traveling in Africa makes people more aware of God and God's protecting hand as you travel. People pray before they set out on a journey. And they thank God when they arrive or return. And as people travel, as they go somewhere, in Hausa you say, Allah yakie hanya. May God watch over your road as you go. Allah yakie hanya. And the Spanish form, you know that one, vaya con Dios. Go with God. Think of the word farewell. That is, may you be well as you go. Jacob has set out on a journey with God's promises, and he's come back, seeing that promise fulfilled. He's gone through all kinds of struggles and difficulties, and now he's back home again, and he builds an altar to show he recognizes that God has been with him and is his God. So maybe that's a, if you're going to go for a hike today, Ale aquí hay Hanya. Vaya con Dios. Go in peace, serve the Lord.